Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Susan Shand, Ashley Thompson, Dorothy Gundy, and John Russell. But first, this report from Brian Lynn.
A new study suggests that the planet Jupiter may have been hit a long time ago by a still-developing planet, one about 10 times the size of Earth. Scientists believe the head-on crash took place not long after Jupiter was formed. Scientists say such a violent collision could explain conditions inside the center of the planet. A report on the study appeared in the publication Nature. Astronomers believe the collision may have happened several million years after the formation of our Sun. The solar system, made up of the Sun and 8 major planets, was formed about 4.6 billion years ago. Jupiter is massive, more than 2 times the size of all other planets in the solar system combined. Jupiter is a gaseous planet, made up mostly of hydrogen and helium. Scientists believe it took shape when gravity pulled in gas and dust left over from the Sun's formation. Researchers have long sought to understand more about Jupiter. In recent years, the U.S. space agency NASA has carried out research on the planet. NASA's Juno spacecraft, launched in 2011, uses instruments to measure the planet's gravitational and magnetic fields. Juno has made interesting findings about Jupiter. It showed that Jupiter likely has a diluted center, one mixed with both light and heavy materials. In the past, scientists theorized that the planet likely had a dense, solid core. In the latest study, researchers examined data and other measurements collected by Juno. They used this information to build models to predict what the planet's core is made of and how it is structured. Their models supported the theory that a head-on collision took place between Jupiter and a still-developing planet. The team's findings suggest the object that hit Jupiter would have been about 10 times the size of Earth. Such a crash involving the 2 massive planets could have broken apart Jupiter's dense core and mixed light elements with heavy ones. Andrea Isela is an astronomer with Rice University in Texas. He helped lead the research. Isela said in a statement he was at first unsure about the collision theory when the idea was presented. "It sounded very unlikely to me," he said, "like a 1 in a trillion probability." But Isela said he began to support the theory when he saw calculations made by another researcher. That researcher was Shongfei Liu, an astronomer from China's Sun Yat-sen University. He said the calculations, which came from computer modeling methods, changed his mind that the theory was not so improbable. The study found there was at least a 40% chance that Jupiter would collide with a still-forming planet within its first few million years. Isela said that scientists already believed such large collisions might have been common while the solar system was still developing. For example, we believe that our moon formed after such an event, he told the Reuters news agency. However, the impact that we postulate for Jupiter is a real monster. Under the theory, the still-developing planet, also known as a protoplanet, would have been swallowed up by Jupiter. Liu said that if the collision had not happened, the protoplanet would have likely went on to become a massive gas planet in our solar system. The researchers also suggest that a similar collision involving the planet Saturn may have happened while the solar system was still young. This may explain the structural differences that exist between Jupiter and Saturn, they said. I'm Brian Lynn.
A few places where the United States manufactured and tested some of the most deadly weapons ever made are now safe for wild animals. One such place is a forest in the state of Indiana. Another can be found on a small island in the Pacific Ocean. The Associated Press reports that a surprising mix of animals and natural habitats are in good health on six former weapons test areas. The U.S. government mainly tested nuclear or chemical weapons on those sites. The government barred people from making visits after the testing ended. Now, these areas belong to wild animals. The government set up wildlife refuges, or shelters, for them under the Fish and Wildlife Service, a federal agency. Today, these areas are home to black bears and black-footed ferrets, coral reefs, rare birds, and even endangered fish. But the cost of setting up the wildlife refuges is huge, and critics say the area are still not clean or safe enough for human beings. The U.S. military, the Department of Energy, and private companies have spent more than $57 billion to clean up the six heavily polluted sites. That amount is based on information gathered by the Associated Press, AP, from military and civil agencies. And the biggest costs have yet to be paid. The Energy Department estimates it will cost between $323 billion and $677 billion more to finish the costliest cleanup. That would be at the Hanford site in Washington State, where the government produced plutonium for bombs and missiles. Even after the cleanups, there is still a lot of contamination at these sites, some experts say. They say this contamination requires restrictions on where visitors can go. They also say the government should watch the areas very closely, possibly for hundreds of years. They would be worse if they were surrounded by a fence and left off limits, said David Havlick. He is a professor at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. He studies efforts to clean up former military sites for wildlife. It would be better if they were cleaned up more, Havlick added. Researchers have yet to examine the health risks to wildlife at the cleaned-up refuges as much as they have studied the risks to humans. However, very few problems have been reported. At least 30 of the more than 560 refuges under the control of the Wildlife Service have some history with the military or weapons, the AP found. Most were not used for making nuclear or chemical weapons. Many of the conversions came after the First and Second World Wars, simply to create more park areas, said Mark Madison, who works as an historian for the Fish and Wildlife Service. But when U.S. relations with the Soviet Union improved in the 1980s, other military lands became refuges. Some were among the most dangerously polluted area in the country. Critics agree that the refuges are valuable, but warn that the natural beauty might hide serious environmental damage. The military closed the sites to keep people safe from the dangerous work that went on there, not to save the environment, noted Havlick of the University of Colorado. Changing a heavily polluted weapons center into a wildlife refuge costs less than making it safe for homes, schools, and businesses, notes Adam Rome. He teaches environmental history at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Critics say Rocky Mountain Arsenal in Colorado shows the problems with a cleanup good enough for animals, but not humans. The arsenal is about 16 kilometers from the center of Denver, Colorado's capital. The area was once an environmental disaster, where chemical weapons and pesticide products were made. Thousands of ducks died after swimming in water there in the 1950s. The government spent $2.1 billion to clean the area and renamed it Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge. It is 61 square kilometers of beautiful fields where visitors can walk or drive a car. But people are still banned from areas where the Army left contaminated dirt. It is illegal to eat fish or any animal from the refuge. Water treatment centers remove contaminants from groundwater to keep them out of people's drinking water. Hanford in Washington may be the most problematic refuge of all. The government has already spent $48 billion, and many more billions are needed. The cost to clean up the contaminated waste is rising quickly. Department of Energy investigators say the project has been mismanaged. Also, Washington state officials are worried that the Trump administration wants to reclassify wastewater at Hanford from high-level radioactive to low-level. The proposed changes would weaken the rules for the cleanup and cut costs. Energy Department officials say there are no plans to change the classification, but state officials say they want long-term and legally effective guarantees. Madison, the Fish and Wildlife Service historian, believes that if agency officials thought the areas were unsafe for the public, they would not work there. "They are there all the time," Madison said. "They're not going to want to be in a place with chemical pollution or radiation problems." I'm Susan Shand.
Today, on our National Parks journey, we travel to the largest state in terms of land area, Alaska. Alaska is home to more national parks than any other state. It is also home to North America's tallest mountain, the 6,190-meter-high Denali Peak. The peak gives the surrounding protected area its name. Welcome to Denali National Park in central Alaska. Denali's grounds cover more than 2.4 million hectares. Within the park are glaciers, clear rivers, peaceful forests, and wildlife such as wolves, moose, bears, and sheep. Denali National Park seems huge, yet only one road goes through the park. Hundreds of thousands of visitors travel down that road each year to experience the Alaskan wild.
Denali National Park was first established 100 years ago. At the time, the park and North America's tallest mountain were known by another name. Many Americans knew the famous peak as Mount McKinley. In the late 1800s, gold miners unofficially named the peak after William McKinley, the 25th U.S. president. At the time, McKinley was still a presidential candidate. McKinley himself never traveled anywhere near the mountain, but the name stuck. In Alaska, however, locals continued to call the mountain Denali. The word Denali means the high one for the Athabascan people, many of whom lived north of the mountain. The area became a national park on February 26, 1917. Its name was Mount McKinley National Park. Some naturalists disagreed with the naming decision. A debate continued for more than half a century, a sign of the area's long and complex history.
In 1975, Alaskan state officials asked the federal government to change the name to Denali to honor the native Alaskans. But congressional members from the state of Ohio, where McKinley was from, opposed and blocked the renaming efforts. In late 1980, weeks before his presidency ended, Jimmy Carter increased the size of the park from 800,000 hectares to 2.4 million hectares. The expanded park also took on a new name. It became the Denali National Park and Preserve. The naming debate, however, was not over. Although the park took the name of Denali, the mountain itself still remained Mount McKinley for another 35 years. In August 2015, former President Barack Obama officially changed the name from Mount McKinley to Denali. The announcement was made shortly before Obama traveled to Alaska. His visit was aimed at publicizing the effects of climate change in the state.
The animals living within Denali National Park are just as famous as its tallest peak. In fact, Denali was the first national park created in order to protect wildlife. The park is home to 39 kinds of mammals and over 160 kinds of birds. Many people come to Denali to see the park's largest mammals. Some moose here weigh well over 500 kilograms. More than 1,700 caribou live within the grounds. Doll sheep flock together on hillsides. Wolves are everywhere in the park. Denali is known as one of the best places to observe wolves in the wild. Giant grizzly bears can also be seen. They enjoy catching salmon and eating wild berries in the summer. Denali also protects the remains of a prehistoric ecosystem. In 2005, geologists discovered fossilized evidence of dinosaur tracks within Denali. Tests showed the fossil to be about 70 million years old. It was the first sign of dinosaurs in central Alaska. Since then, scientists have discovered more than 300 fossil sites. The fossils preserve evidence of other ancient creatures and many kinds of plants. With each discovery, a more complete picture of Denali's past comes to life.
Adventure-seeking travelers visit Denali to climb North America's tallest peak. The first successful climb to the very top happened on June 7, 1913, when four men reached the summit. Every year, more than 1,000 people try to reach Denali's summit. Only about half of them succeed. Climbing Denali is extremely difficult. Climbers face harsh conditions and extreme weather. Winds can blow at speeds of more than 160 kilometers an hour. They must use special equipment to travel along glacier ice and difficult terrain. The Kahiltna Glacier is the longest glacier here. Climbers know it as the starting point for summiting Denali. It sees some of the most extreme temperatures of any place on Earth. Most successful climbs take about 3 weeks. Several local businesses offer group climbs.
Visitors can enjoy Denali in more restful ways, too. Many people travel by bus along the park's single road. Travel companies offer half-day bus tours. Others choose to ride bicycles along the long road. This gives them a chance to get up close to Denali's wildlife and peaceful environment. The park operates 6 campsites and offers several kilometers of trails. Denali is also home to a group of sled dogs. These Alaskan Huskies are an important part of the park experience. Visitors can watch sled dog demonstrations in the summer to learn about this traditional Alaskan way of travel.
The park's past, present, and future connect many different cultures and people across time. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
From Paris to Berlin, European cities are searching for ways to deal with a trend that is affecting cities worldwide: electric scooters. Supporters say scooters are a jump into the future and a fun way to travel without creating pollution. Critics, on the other hand, note growing numbers of injuries and even deaths involving e-scooters. European countries are dealing with scooters in different ways. Paris has many e-scooter companies, and France's capital has at least 20,000 scooters traveling on its streets. This week, the French government met with the victims of scooter accidents as it prepares new rules. The rules, expected in September, will likely place speed limits of about 20 kilometers an hour in most areas and 8 kilometers an hour in areas where many people walk. Nationwide, fines for speeding could go up to $1,680. Berlin, Germany's capital, legalized electric scooters 2 months ago. The government quickly realized it needed new rules. Last week, city officials announced plans for parking areas for scooters, which riders often leave on sidewalks. In southeastern Europe's Balkan countries, e-scooters are still operating in a legal gray zone, except for Slovenia. The country is working on legislation that will restrict the devices to pedestrian areas and bicycle lanes. The rules will restrict speeds to 25 kilometers an hour, but in pedestrian areas, electric scooters will have to stay at the speed of a walking person. Scooters will be subject to the same rules as bicycles, and underage scooter riders will be required to have lights and helmets. Europe is not the only area struggling with how to deal with scooters. They are increasingly becoming an issue of debate in the United States. Scooter companies, in many cases, deployed the devices throughout major American cities without permission or permits. A recent report by the National Association of City Transportation Officials noted that in 2018, Americans took 38.5 million trips on shared electric scooters. However, the future of rules for scooters in the U.S. remains an open question. I'm John Russell.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.